This is Shudders Inc. with Bruce Williams and Glyn Lavender.
Hi, and welcome to episode 214 of Shudders Inc. This is Bruce Williams from ShuddersIncPodcast.com, and joining me on the line via Skype from Melbourne once again, Mr. Glyn Lavender. How are you?
I'm absolutely marvellous.
Excellent.
No. This is genuine this time.
As opposed to the last 4 weeks.
Yeah, all the rest of the thoughts are full of. Yeah, but now, today, whew, I tell you, tie me down, hose me down to the cold water. I'm excited.
Fantastic. So, what have you been up to this week?
Nothing.
Oh, okay. How was Mackay? You obviously made it back.
I did. We made it up there. You know, funny, if it rained all the way up there, and for once I got off the plane and stopped.
Oh.
And it didn't rain again until I left.
Wow.
Yeah, so I'm thinking of changing the company name to Can Produce Drought.
Yeah.
Instead of Can Produce Water. It was marvellous. We had a great time. Had an awesome impromptu beach shoot after a flash workshop. Just the two models and this incredible beach up there with this incredible rock structure.
Oh, nice.
Absolutely howling wind, dust, sand flying everywhere. And yeah, we had like a 15-minute window of opportunity to shoot. Awesome, great sunset, which just all came together in an extremely short period of time. And so I got a couple of lovely shots out of that, which I was rather pleased with, considering the short period of time. There was three of us shooting, and we had about 10 minutes in total. So we had 3 minutes at bat each kind of thing.
Yeah, right.
And to get three or four shots each, we had two models. We had to make sure each of them got a reasonable amount of shots.
Yeah.
And the conditions, it was tough. But we had a ball doing that. That was a lot of fun.
Cool.
And straight back to Melbourne, and I stupidly ran two workshops in one day, which is... It's not something I do on a fairly regular basis, but generally if I do two workshops, I like to do two creative workshops in the same day.
Right.
As opposed to this one was an understanding your camera workshop, followed by a creative workshop. And it's very hard after doing an understanding your camera, which can kind of do your head in. It's the hardest workshop to run because of people's knowledge base is the lowest, so it's hard to be creative after that.
Sure.
And but that evening, I then ran a creative art nude workshop that night.
Wow.
Which, even though I could say mentally I was a little fatigued before the start of it, the adrenaline kicks in. We had some great fun. Had a great model. She was incredibly patient with the old saying: the more uncomfortable the pose, the better the photo. That kind of stuff to the poor girl. I actually my hamstrings went out in cramp in sympathy.
Oh, okay.
But some of the shots were lovely, so that's the main thing.
Excellent.
Followed up by a flash workshop the next morning, so three in 2 days. I kind of put myself under the pump a little bit, but that's the way it should be. I mean, I can't complain. I only work 2 days a week.
So. Well, I guess if you're only going to work 2 days, you might as well make them good ones.
Well, do your best. But I mean, two in a row too. It's not like just 2 days over an entire 7 day period. It's Friday followed by Saturday, two in a row.
Oh,
I don't know how those people do Monday to Friday.
That's hideous.
And I'm still recovering. I've got my manservant just massaging my feet right now, actually, just to take the stress off.
Fantastic.
So it was a good week. A good week photographically. That Mackay workshops went well. The people were lovely as always. We had a token male and 13 women. tends to be the case, and lots and lots of fun, lots of laughs.
Awesome.
And your week, how was it? Do I hear a little croakiness in your voice from singing along to some music?
Last night I was at the first of the three Sydney concerts for Bruce Springsteen last night, and it was just unbelievable. For those who...
That bad, was it?
For those,
unbelievable.
For those who don't know, I am a massive, massive Springsteen fan. Last night was my 8th concert, and before all the American listeners go, eight, just bear in mind that he has only been to Australia 4 times in his career, and they have been at 10-year intervals. So last night was just awesome. The two concerts he did in Brisbane were over 3 hours. Last night here in Sydney was 2 hours 40, and I then had to ride home from Sydney to Gosford on the motorbike after the concert, and it rained on the way, so that wasn't the most enjoyable trip. So I'm a bit under it tonight, and I'm backing up with the second concert tomorrow night. So,
at your age.
Yeah, exactly. So Thursday's going to be tough, and there's a slim possibility that I may end up with a ticket for the third show, so for Friday night. So I am going to be wrecked come Saturday.
Do you know how you know you're getting old when you go to concerts?
No.
When you walk into the venue and see there's no seats and start to panic. What? I'm going to stand for 2 hours? Straight? Yeah, if there's no seats, I'm not going. Simple as that.
Springsteen's probably the only guy that I'd be happy to stand for 3 hours. Yeah, he does put on an amazing show. So
never been a fan. A friend of mine is probably one of the world's saddest. I'm sorry, one of the world's most dedicated Springsteen fans, and he's tried very hard to get me into it, and I just can't do it.
I think you know, you kind of have to have followed his career in real time. I don't know that he's the kind of artist that you can absorb all of the back catalogue in one hit and then try
I remember The River Coming Out.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I remember The Beatles on the charts, dude. Yeah, the first time round, you know.
I mean, having said that, I didn't get into Springsteen until Born in the USA because, you know, I was 16 when that came out. And yeah, and that was the very first concert I ever went to, was the Born in the USA tour. And that set the bar very high. Sorry?
Did you get to put a wig on and dance on stage?
No, I didn't.
That would have been a 16-year-old boy's dream, I would have imagined.
I don't know about that, but anyway. But it did set the bar incredibly high in terms of what a good rock concert was like.
I'll give him his dues that he doesn't put on just the standard 90-minute show, exactly the same song.
No, yeah, he doesn't.
He's actually a musician who plays for the sake of it. You know, and I love that. That's something you've got to respect, even if you don't quite get into the music.
Yeah, and you know, for a guy who's 63 years of age to be putting on a 3-hour show, you know, that puts to shame guys who are half of his age. You know,
it gives us hope. Is that what you're saying? Yeah. In a few years, when we're that age,
I think. Yeah, you can look at it like that. So anyway. So that's what this week's looking like. Over the weekend, I took a trip out to Trundle with Jaden.
Isn't that a bed? That little bed that goes underneath.
Yes, a Trundle bed. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
Is that where they come from? Is that where they make them?
I have no idea. I very much doubt it.
Ask when you go up there. Say, can I see the factory, please? They'll say, what factory? You know, the bed factory, the Trundles.
So we went out there and checked out the farm. I mean, obviously he knew what it looked like because he grew up there, but you know, we just wanted to make sure that it was what I was looking for this shoot.
Is it looking good?
Yeah, I'm excited by it. There's you know, heaps of old farm machinery out there, and really nice old wool shed. So we'll do some stuff in the wool shed through the middle of the day when the sun's overhead. And,
you're very, very optimistic there, aren't you?
Yeah, I am. This is an area that doesn't see a lot of rainfall, so I think our chances of being rained on are pretty slim. So anyway.
Well, when's the weekend again?
19th, Friday the 19th, Saturday the 20th, and Sunday 21st of April.
Next month, yeah.
Yeah, so about a month away. So
nice.
Looking forward to it.
Very, very nice. Well, can't wait to see the photos.
Yeah. Absolutely. I'm
no looking. Pressure, but people are waiting. People are watching. People are here.
Yeah. I'm sure.
But no pressure.
Thank you.
Gotta love that, don't you?
So what have we got on the agenda for this week?
Oh, tell you what, there's been nefarious goings on in the Australian photo industry.
Oh?
Nefarious.
Really?
In the Australian photo retail industry. Now, I think it was either last week or the week before's podcast where I said Australia's second largest camera store went under.
Yes, yeah.
Well, whilst I was away in Mackay, the owner rang, and so I wrote a piece on it for I do a weekly newsletter for the Australian photo industry. I'm fairly heavily involved in behind the scenes with a lot of stuff with boards and things like that. But I wrote a fairly emotional piece looking from the human perspective of the staff who've worked there over the 26 years that have been there, kind of thing. And so he rang, and I'm kind of glad I took it. Was a voicemail because I was doing the workshop in Mackay, because kind of sounded like he was crying. So I don't know if I could have quite handled that. But he did say one thing which kind of piqued my interest, and that was, oh, we've been shafted.
Oh.
That's interesting. Anyway, we've got to be very careful what we say, because I hear there's quite a few chances of legal proceedings going on.
Okay.
But anyway, so that closed down, and then straight away another Canberra house store opened up in its place, like within days, which is kind of curious.
Right.
But what's interesting is that a couple of days ago, an anonymous email went out to all sorts of people in the industry, and pretty much criticising the head office of the group, of the buying group that this store was a part of,
right.
Criticising the general manager, the directors, the financial controller, and all sorts of stuff. And it was written as from the inside, as in, I'm a Canberra House member. Oops, mentioned the company. I'm a House member, and you can edit that out later. And
do I need to?
No, I think it should be okay. Everyone knows it's a Canberra House store that went out of business.
Right.
But it was written as in a store owner being very disgruntled with the way things are going, and on and on and on. And so it caused a fair bit of ruckus in itself.
Right.
And but one of the main beefs was that the group had started importing their own accessories under their own brand name.
Okay.
And this person was saying, it's a terrible decision, all these horrible things about it, what a silly thing to be doing. Turns out it wasn't written by one of the stores after all, even though it sort of, every word sort of implied that it was.
Ooh.
Turns out it was written by one of the suppliers.
Ooh.
Pretending to be one of the store owners.
Ooh.
Sent out anonymously. So it's crazy stuff.
Wow.
All sorts of imploding, all sorts of things going on. It's fascinating stuff.
So was there like some email spoofing going on to make it look like it had come from an internal email address or something like that?
No, it was just written like, we members and we have the right and us owners.
Ooh.
And at the AGM, we heard from pretty much everything aiming to be a store, and turned that not to be so much a store. So here's a little tip for young players for you out there.
Mm-hmm.
When you open up a Microsoft Word document for the very first time, when you install the software, it wants you to put your name in.
Yes.
Don't do that. Just then the documents that you save on it, mm-hmm. built into the data is your name.
That's right.
Built into the document that this email
it's out. It's essentially metadata.
Yes, and this guy's name's built into the data of the email.
Oops.
Dun, 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 dun.
Ooh.
So that all started to come down today. So it's
wow.
Just see what where it comes from. That's been an interesting thing to be watching. And the good news is, at the end of the day, that with this new store opening, quite a lot of the old staff got their jobs back.
Oh, well, that's good.
And that's the positive side of things is that, the important people in this world, the people who work in businesses, most of them are looked after, so that was good.
Oh, fantastic.
So a lot of old friends of mine now have gainful employment again. And when I know these people have wives and children who depend on their income, that's a good thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that was a bit of interesting going on during the week. What else to say? I've been working with my wonderfully good friend, David Oakley. Rebuild, Dave.
I do know David. David did my Bruce Williams photography website for me.
Did he really?
He did. He's a legend.
Oh, he's a legend in his own lunchtime. Not that he eats much lunch, but but he's so we're rebuilding my web page today. So it's been a bit of fun having building some ideas around that, and that should be launched hopefully in the next two or three years.
Is this to change some sort of functionality wise, or is it just I just
hate the look of it.
Oh, okay.
Just quite bluntly, it's just too busy and it's old and just needed a whole new kick up the guts.
A refresh.
So it's going to super, super simple. I want to try and match my personality, so I'm going really simple.
Nice.
if it's just a photo and book a workshop button.
Right. Lovely.
That'd work. send money here. That'd work. Surely.
That's it.
Maybe this will be more complex than that. And maybe I'll have a logo as well. So in the midst of rebuilding that, which is awesome. So I'm pretty pleased that's it's happening. It's been on the card since before Christmas. So finally got a chance for today.
So now you're up to three objects on the page, dude. I wouldn't be making it any more complex than that.
Exactly. Logo, picture, send money button.
That's it.
Yeah. And direct to my Swiss bank account. Exactly. Yeah,
that's it.
And actually, I think, yeah, maybe, yeah, it has to go to Swiss. Don't send it to the Cyprus bank's accounts. You'll lose 10% of it straight away. It's pointless. It's like GST. that's a horrible thing. So, yeah, that was good. I said I've been looking at an interesting little page today.
Mm-hmm.
It's a on Fake It Till You Make It is what it's called.
Okay.
And it's on pre-Photoshop photoshopping.
Okay.
So I'm going to pull up the page here whilst I'm talking about it. There's an exhibition going on of how they used to fake photographs before Photoshop came out.
Right, so and image manipulation in the darkroom.
Exactly right, you know, and, okay. And it's quite fascinating. Some of it for political purposes, some of it just for creative purposes, trying to overcome the limitations of gear, which we still kind of face today.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's on... the NPR website.
Say that again. NPR.
NPR.
Yeah. National Public Radio out of the US.
Yes. Yep. And they've got a segment called The Picture Show.
Oh, right.
On NPR, and it's talking about this exhibition that's going on. You can listen to the whole. There's a whole 5-minute sort of interview on it, and so in the National Gallery of Art in Washington DC, they've got this exhibition going on. There's some pretty cool stuff. Some great photos.
Wow.
And I think, there's like men sitting in bottles and, the old, people blending into walls, multiple exposures, just kind of cool stuff that, people thought could only be done with Photoshop.
Yeah, right.
But I think what fascinated me the most was this series of photographs of Lennon. Not McCartney Lennon, the other one. The one who couldn't play guitar.
Yeah.
That I know of. I don't want to cast aspersions, but I don't think he could. Don't think he could play guitar. But it's a series of four photographs taken. Well, the one photograph was taken of him and his four closest buddies in the movement.
Okay.
But as they came under less popular favour with him, they started disappearing from the photograph.
Oh, really?
So it starts out with him and his four closest buddies, and ends up just him and one bloke by himself. that's kind of cool. That's a political use of images, which is fascinating as well. So,
yeah, right.
So we'll put the link of that into the show notes, but I think it's kind of a cool thing to look at. And maybe a lot of new photographers didn't realise just how much trickery went on pre-Photoshop.
It's pretty amazing. I do remember seeing a website, probably 18 months ago now, that had a whole bunch of images from like the 1800s and showed how they had... Not the process by which they'd been manipulated, but showed the end result of the manipulation. And to see some of these things that had been done, and then to realise that this was all done with dodging and burning in a dark room, where there was no curves adjustments, no levels adjustments, like we're used to in
no layers, so you can erase your mistakes.
Exactly.
Incredible skill.
Phenomenal.
Incredible skill.
Something
that, there's no press a button for an action to happen in those days. Press this and something magically disappears.
And no undo either if you stuffed it up.
Exactly. So fascinating. Great skill.
Yeah. Look forward to having a look at that link.
Yeah, there's only a handful of photos on that thing, but I think it's a fascinating topic.
Yeah,
and great thing for people to look into and just sort of get it. You know what, gives you some kind of cool ideas too. Stuff you might not have thought of. I could do that with a man in a bottle for sure. So that's great. But what attracted me, other than the Lennon photos, was just some of the comments from people below.
Right.
On this article. And one of them, which I really like, and I thought this could be interesting to have a wee chat on.
Yeah.
And the comment was, even if you don't physically alter the image, isn't composition itself a form of manipulation?
Hmm. I guess it is.
Because remember, it's what you're leaving out of the frame is taking away from the story. It could be. I mean, well, you think about it, if it's a couple of political leaders meeting, and you don't include one of them in the shot, then you'd never, unless if you don't read the text, you'd never know that person was there. That's manipulation.
Sure.
Yeah. You know, if it's communist country, it's a quick way to get rid of someone.
Yeah.
Real estate photography is a classic example. You know, if you don't include the hole in the wall in the photograph, as far as people know, it doesn't exist.
Yeah, right.
So your composition really does manipulate people's vision of what the world is.
Yeah.
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 You might see a beautiful flowing stream and deer and trees, but if you don't have the paper pulp mill in the shot that's at the end of that, you think it's an idyllic place to go. You spend all your time to get there. What's this paper mill doing?
Yeah.
You know,
yep.
Composition is manipulation.
Yeah, okay. I'll go along with that.
Well, I thought it'd be a bit more dynamic discussion than that. Yes.
Well, I guess I see your point. Like, it is manipulation of the events, but it's not manipulation of an already established photograph.
No, it's not changing the photograph, but it's manipulation as far as how people perceive what the image is about, what the context is of the image. If you photograph a little daisy, just a daisy by itself growing up, with a lovely bit of light on it, it's all beautifully lit and lovely out of focus bouquet, and you don't see that it's actually growing out of a crack in the pavement in the middle of the city. You know, this perception of the world is how we can create it. I think it's a great thing that we can do that. I think that we can change the way the world looks just by what we leave out of a photograph. I'm always saying whilst training that what we leave out is just as important as what we leave in.
Oh, absolutely.
So that's how it shows the world is just a massive difference by how we compose.
Do you know, I think back in the days when Shelton was on this podcast, I may have told this analogy once before, but it was either George Martin, Sir George Martin as he is now, or the other fella, the engineer, Emery.
No, Lennon. Oh, that was a different one.
who was the engineer for the Beatles. I'm pretty sure it was Sir George Martin, made the comment that although they would, record oodles and oodles and oodles and oodles of tracks for a song, like, different guitar parts or different vocal parts or different percussion parts or whatever, his attitude was always when it came to mixing the song, it was always, what is the least, amount of what we've recorded that we can put in and still convey the essence of the song? So it was all about, don't put in any more than is absolutely necessary. Go with the bare minimum that gets the idea across.
Tell the story as simple as possible.
Yeah. There's kind of a great parallel way to
shoot.
There.
Yeah. It's a great way to shoot, yeah. Yeah. Include as few elements as possible to tell the story. So it's a good thing.
Yeah.
Well, we've got something. We've got 3 minutes of airtime out of it. That's not bad.
Absolutely.
Not bad at all. It's always trying to get people, when training people, it's always trying to say, trying to get people thinking about how they see the world and trying to get these concepts of manipulation as an example, or telling the story as simply as possible. It gets you thinking about the shot more.
Yep.
And I think the more we can slow down, the more we can think about, what's the story we're telling with the photo, the better our photos will be.
Yes.
Because we're in such a rush to shoot these days that we tend to either we tell the story in 10,000 photos, rather than six. it just tends to overdo it. I mean, I know I'm as guilty as the next person. Fortunately, there's no one else in the room with me, so I'm not as guilty as anybody. But we just tend to overshoot and overdo everything. But slowing down and thinking about the story, because what are photos other than the stories?
Mm-hmm. It's back to your astronaut and the girl going to the bathroom, isn't it?
It is. Yeah. For a second there, I was wondering where you're going, but I remember. For those who weren't listening 3 weeks ago, go back and listen. exactly. About how we shoot these days compared to how we used to shoot, which gives us a fantastic segue.
Yes.
Yeah, you know those segues, those little machines you run. Yeah. So about how many photos we take.
Yeah.
And the Henri Cartier-Bresson quote we were talking about earlier.
Sure.
That his quote saying that your first 10,000 photos are the worst.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that's back in the days when he was only taking, you know, 8 to 10 to 12 photos per film.
Yeah.
You know, it's a hell of a lot of films. It's a thousand spools of film to get there.
Yep.
What does that translate to today?
When we're so trigger happy, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, 10,000 photos for some people is a weekend.
Yeah, exactly.
I saw that one guy advertising for weddings said he'd only give you the best 4,000 photos from your wedding.
Oh, you're only kidding.
Only the best ones. He'd keep the rest himself. Oh, he'd just give you the best 4,000.
Was that for real?
For real.
Oh, no. $399
he charged. Oh. And he'll give you the best 4,000 photos on 47 discs, I think. Something like
no
that.
No way.
Yeah, way.
I've not pursued wedding photography, but out of the handful of weddings that I have done, I generally don't hand over any more than about 150 images.
You try and keep it under 3,000?
Yeah. Look, I shoot on a wedding about 800 images. And I figure
I'd say that's probably on the low side these days. But
yeah, but I'd rather be, I don't know. I guess it comes back to what you were just saying a minute ago about slow down, think it out. You know, yeah. I'd rather take a little bit more time to think about what I wanted in the shot and, you know, then fire off a couple of frames to make sure.
Back in the early 80s and in the days of 120, when everyone shot 120, you'd only have 80 to 100 shots per wedding.
Yeah, right.
That's, you know, bride getting ready to, you know, people getting pissed at the party afterwards.
Yeah.
They're cutting the cake and champagne. That's not the same thing. But you'd have 80 to 100 photos. That's all you had for the day. So you couldn't afford to make mistakes.
No.
Couldn't afford to be trigger happy because, you know, you've only got, you know, let's say you're there for 10 hours, so 8 hours, say 10 photos an hour. Yeah. And you want to make sure you get that incredibly right. So.
Yeah. So when you think that, you know, Henri Cartier-Bresson was talking about, you know, the first 10,000 images that actually counted, like, so he's talking about 10,000 images that you actually seriously put some effort into.
Yeah.
And, yeah, and then you ask about, you know, how does that translate today? Wow.
I think you've got to put your little finger by the corner of your mouth and go, 100 million.
Yeah, exactly.
$1 million. Yeah. Well, you know, you kind of... Well, let's think about it. Let's say it is 1 million photos. Let's just throw a massive figure out there.
So that's...
Which
that's,
it kind of translates.
That's probably around about 6 to 7 professional DSLR bodies that you've worn out.
Exactly. Now, most people may not know that the cameras have a finite amount of shots in them before they kick the bucket.
Yeah, well, before the shutter dies anyway.
Yeah, and that generally, cost-effectiveness-wise, often rules, especially on the less professional models, tends to,
chuck it, buy a new one.
Exactly. Yeah. And so want societies that we want to anyway, but, so you've worn out, 10 to 15 cameras to get to a point where you're starting to get good. Yeah. Well, I mean, he didn't say, you know, the first 10,000 are your worst, your next 10,000 are you're not quite as bad as the rest, and then your next 10,000 are a little bit better than the crap you were shooting a little bit ago, yeah, who knows, you know? Frankly, look at some of his shots, and by today's standard, they are pretty bland, and, yeah, but,
sure,
yeah, you're not in that era to see what is you know, what it was like, what everyone else was shooting,
yeah.
But yeah, you know, it's an incredible amount of, you know, I guess it's your...
But he didn't have the, you know, things like wireless multi-camera, you know, off-camera flash units all firing in sync and, you know, things that...
But imagine if he did.
Okay. Well, yeah.
He used to use flash powder, didn't he? Just put a string of powder down, just put a line of powder down the road and just light that as the bike went past. It'd be fun to try that, though, you know?
What's that?
Using old flash powder.
Right.
You
know,
But actually, I'm doing like the fireworks, you know, bunches around the place. Try to set them all off. And, you could have some, yeah, off camera powder, it would be probably called those days.
Oh, dear.
But yeah, but his apprenticeship, basically, he says there's 10,000 photos. I mean, what's the modern apprenticeship? When do you finally, I mean, when do you finally feel you're starting to get good?
Well, I know I've mentioned this before. I think it's this quote is from Stephen Levitt, the author of Freakonomics, about the concept of 10,000 hours to be good at, you know, to become a master of any craft, you need to spend about 10,000 hours doing it.
Wow.
That
would mean there's only very few things in my life that I'm a master at.
Breathing.
Oh, there's that one. Yeah. Anyway, we'll leave that one alone. Yep.
Yeah.
Now it's interesting talking about apprenticeship. So I've been having a little online discussion this week with the lead singer of a band called Lamb of God.
Oh, really?
Randy Blythe, and he's taken up shooting in the last year.
Okay.
And they're
a US band, aren't they?
They are a US band. Yeah. But you know, he's a fanatical shooter, and I've got to say, you know, for someone who's been shooting for less than a year, some of his stuff is very, very good.
Okay.
I mean, very grungy, very strong, you know, powerful imagery. But yeah, the sort of music he plays is that kind of stuff as well. Anyway, but you know, he's very fanatical about trying to find his style.
Okay.
Well, I haven't found my style yet. I don't know what my style is. What's my style? And I don't know if there is such a thing.
I think you do eventually start to...
Well, yeah, I think you might have some things that you do all the time, but if you got to a style and stopped, wouldn't you give up?
Yeah.
Don't you always want to be better?
In the handful of episodes when I was doing this podcast on my own, I came across a blog.
All alone. All alone.
I was all alone.
You have to answer your own questions, laugh at your own jokes.
That's it. Exactly. I came across this blog, and it was a guy in Helsinki, and he had this great analogy where he said, you know, from the center of Helsinki, there's this bus depot, and all these bus routes head out from the depot. And he said, I draw the analogy of your photographic journey, if you like. It's like you leave that depot and you get on one bus, and it might be the wedding bus. You know, you decide you're going to do wedding photography. And you go down that path a certain way, and you then start to become frustrated by, you know, the people who tell you you don't know anything, or everything you're doing has been done before by people who came before you, and
Henry Cartier Bresson again.
and so you hop off the bus and you go back to the depot and you get on the other bus, you know, you get on the real estate bus, you know. And he said the thing is that all those buses, they leave that depot, and quite a few of them will all follow the same route for a certain period of time until eventually they diverge off into unique paths. And he said that, you know, your journey as a photographer is very much like that. You start down a particular genre of photography, and you will be influenced by those who have come before you, and you will mimic as a form of learning, and that only by continuing on and, you know, just keep doing and keep absorbing ideas from different areas, that eventually you'll be out on a tangent where no one else has been, and you'll then become the thing that photographers after you will start to mimic, because you sort of blazed your own trail, as it were.
I know what that's called.
Right.
Bullshit. It's just a load of crap. You
don't believe it? You don't think so?
Well, I don't think you... I think the day you settle for where you are, the day you settle for the style, the day you become complacent and happy with what you're doing, is the day you put your camera down and go do something else.
I agree. You never stop learning. You do need to...
But it's not just learning. I mean, surely it doesn't matter how good you are at a particular style of photo. you know, you're a master of doing this particular angle with this particular post-process look, with this particular light, with these particular subjects.
Yep.
You can only do that for so long before you just want to just, you know, drive your head into a wall.
Oh, absolutely.
You know? And so therefore you want to try something else. And therefore that's, that means your style has to keep, whatever style it is, it's got to keep developing. It's got to keep changing for your entire life.
Definitely. Definitely.
So therefore, and as this guy is so desperate, he's starting out, he's trying to find his style. Well, mm-hmm. Why? You know, find how to do stuff. Find stuff you like and learn how to do it, but keep on moving. You don't ever settle for where you are, because there's no fun in that.
Does his quest to find a style have to imply that he's only ever going to shoot the same type of image?
Well, what not when they say the same, but his look has to be the same to be his style.
Right.
Surely he's got to have his look.
Okay.
How else would you define style? What's your thought of style be?
Yeah.
Let's see what your style is.
Okay. I'm still processing
you don't got to agree with me. Yeah.
I guess you're right. When I think of the style of a photographer, I guess it is, you know they either, you know, they always shoot in black and white, or you know they always go for a highly, you know, really vivid high contrast, you know, look, or they, you know, love a particular lens, you know, that...
Are you looking at a certain era of their photos? Are you looking at this particular wedge of time when they were doing that? You know, when they were starting out, and they were, did they move on beyond that? Did they, you know... I don't know. Maybe it's just a personal thing. Maybe it's my own insecurities as a photographer that... if I was ever to stop wanting to do something different as far as how my photos looked, I don't know if I'd be satisfied.
Yeah, I can agree with that.
I mean, I'm never happy with what I shoot. I don't think I ever have been, and probably ever will be.
You're happy with it at the time, but within 6 months, you sort of.
No, I'm never even happy. I'm not even happy with the time usually. because there's always something, especially because most of my shooting these days is just workshop shots.
Yeah.
And so, therefore, there's no time to perfect a shot.
Yeah.
There's no time to take that time we were just talking about, because I've got, you know, 30 seconds to set up and shoot, and then let the other 10 people in. So you look at your photos and now, if her head was 3 inches that way, if her nose was down, you don't have a chance to take time to perfect photos. Maybe I should. It's a goal of mine. I always keep saying to myself, well, one of these days I'll get out and actually, you know, spend more time just shooting for myself. But
yeah,
you know, that's life. You know, no one has time, even though I don't work very much.
Well, when you get to India, there'll be very few distractions.
But, you know, even then, realistically, look, I mean, I'm going there with a fixed agenda of what I need to shoot for the workshop I'm building.
Yeah, right.
So therefore, you know, I'm constraining myself. Now, obviously, I'll take whatever opportunities come my way, but I am still constraining myself to a formula of photograph taking to explain, because I'm trying to teach people how to shoot travel photography. Mm-hmm. I want to keep a very strict formula about, you know, how to solve problems, how to deal with, you know, what comes, expectations, and so on. Who knows? We'll just have to see. We'll have to see if I come back feeling good about the world.
You know what? I would hazard a guess that if you haven't already noticed this, you will reasonably soon, that being under that pressure of conducting a workshop, you know, all of the time, and as you said, you know, you don't get to perfect a pose exactly the way, you know, in hindsight you kind of look at the image and go, oh, we could have done this, we could have done that. I would imagine that will eventually, if it hasn't already, start to increase your mental capacity to get to that place faster.
Oh, look, yeah, I mean, to some degree, but yeah, there's, everything takes time. Remember most of, whenever you're teaching something, you're not necessarily in a creative zone anyway. So yeah, sure. Every nuance. And the thing is, the way I teach, I never, I don't like to have a preconceived idea of what the photo is going to be. I don't like to think about what we're going to shoot until we're walking trying to find something to shoot.
Right.
I have a couple of set things that we need to do, but the rest is, you know, environmentally what comes our way, lighting what comes our way, whatever idea springs up at the time.
So in that respect, you're kind of a polar opposite to Shelton.
Oh, yeah.
Because he was always on about, you know, having a pre-visualized idea.
Yeah, no.
So you,
if you haven't, if the listeners haven't told or noticed already, I am the polar opposite of Shelton. I am his evil twin. It's what gets back that creativity. If you come up with a preconceived idea of what you're going to do, but the world doesn't let you do that when you get out there to do it, that preconceived idea can stifle the opportunities that are in front of you.
Sure.
So I go out there with just
an open mind.
I wonder what I can see. Well, open or just the wind blowing through the ears and just like a whistling sound. with no mind. And just see what's thrown at you and deal with the situation, because every day is different. Every day, you know, every person you're shooting, every person you're training is different. Every environment you're in is different. So you just have to feel it.
Yep.
Yeah. Fly by the seat of your pants, I guess. And for better or worse... Yeah,
yep.
It works sometimes. It works better other times. Sometimes it's less satisfying than you would like. Yeah, but as I always say at workshops, it doesn't really matter if you go home with not one good photograph. Yeah, as long as you understand the principles of how to do stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to go home with my style. I'm doing those little, you know, flickety flickies with my fingers.
Right.
You don't want to go home. It's not about what I'm showing you how to shoot. It's the principle of how to shoot. That's the most important thing.
Sure.
Yeah. So, yeah, the photo may be, you know, the wind's blowing like crazy and hair's not quite where you want it, but that's not important because that shot's not important.
Right.
The principle of what you're learning, how to do that kind of lighting or how to do that kind of setup, is the important thing. The actual shot itself on the day is not particularly important.
Yeah.
I always feel that. I know a lot of people come there and they want to build their portfolios and that sort of stuff with images, but to me... it's kind of pointless going home with 10 great images that you can't reproduce. It's a waste of time and money.
Yeah, for sure.
For them, and you know, I feel I've failed if someone goes home not knowing how to recreate that effect of lighting or that effect of posing or whatever it needs to be on the particular day.
Yeah. That's fair enough.
Just different ways of seeing the world, I guess, isn't it? Yeah, and that's the thing. I mean, the other day on this beach, in this beach shoot in Mackay, was, yeah, you have 15 minutes. You've got to a location you've never seen before. You have no idea. It's howling wind.
Yep.
Well, you know, you work with. Yeah, if you go there with some ideas about what you're going to shoot, and you're faced with that, you know, crazy. Yeah, but if you go there with absolutely no ideas and just look and go, "Oh, that's cool.
Yep.
Wonder what we can do there," and just build it from there, then you've got maybe take some of the stress off you, a little bit of the pressure off you, maybe.
Mm-hmm. But mate, that probably comes with the confidence of having done lots of shooting too.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, absolutely. Like I look at people like Scott Kelby who train, and they train people to shoot mostly in aperture priority, and exposure compensates.
Yep.
Well, if you've got years and years of experience of looking at light and knowing how much you need to compensate that shot for, you can get there fairly quickly.
Yeah.
But if you're learning and you have no idea whether it's one stop, two stops, three stops, 10 stops out, it's going to be a very, very frustrating way to shoot. So that's just an experience. With the more experience you are at doing it, then, you know, the easier it is to do that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, of course, that just means go and take more photos. Get past your 10,000 hours or your 10,000 photos or your million photos and get to that point.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, a lot of the teaching I do when I'm teaching people how to learn how to use their cameras properly for the first time, I equate to learning how to drive a car for the first time. You know, you're going to bunny hop. You're going to grind some gears.
Yep.
In Australia, you need like 120 hours of practice before you can go for your license.
Yep.
and I say, you know, to learn how to use a camera, you know, to learn where all the buttons are and get fluid with changing your main settings, you know, 20 or 30 hours just sitting with your camera in your hand just twirling dials is invaluable.
Yeah.
Just sit in front of the TV for 20 minutes a night for a couple of weeks until you can turn all, you know, your aperture, shutter priority, shutter button, ISO, white balance, bang, without looking at your camera.
Yep.
Once you start getting that flow, then you start worrying about the technical stuff so much, and away you go.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, driving a car, you've got, you know, accelerator, you've got a clutch and gears, three things you've got to balance all the time.
And in a steering.
Camera. Well, the steering's not as important as the going. You know?
Okay.
Because you can sit there and steer in a car that's not going anywhere, and it's not going to do anything.
Fair enough. Yeah.
But to actually get the car moving with fluidity,
yes,
you've got to balance those. A manual car, you've got to balance those three elements.
Yep.
In a camera, it's shutter speed, aperture, and ISO. You've got to balance those three fluidly.
Yes.
So once you get to that point of fluidity of adjusting those three, you're not going to bunny hop in your photography so much.
Yeah.
You're not going to stumble and grind gears. And you know what happens is your concentration goes away from the box to the world. You start looking at the world. Yeah, when you start to drive a car for the first time, you're so much concentrating on where your feet are, where that gear lever is, that it is hard to actually watch where you're going.
Yes.
Yeah, but eventually you start getting more fluid there, and you start to look at the world beyond you, and yeah, life becomes a bit easier.
Yeah.
And I think whilst ever you're stuck in the box, your photography is going to be stifled.
Yeah.
Because technically you're stuck. I say people learn to shoot in three dimensions.
Okay.
This is another one of my very, very weird ways of looking at the world, is that when you first start out, you're stuck at this box, and the first dimension, this box that's right in front of your face.
Right.
And all your concentration, all your conscious thought is stuck in the, which button does what? What's the shutter speed? What's an aperture? What do I turn?
Yep.
But as you get more comfortable with that, you go, let's say you're shooting a person, then your next stage of development, you start looking more at the person. So whilst you're in that first dimension, whilst you're starting to get the camera right, the person's always got stuff growing out of their heads. They're always out of focus. They haven't got good looks on the face. All that kind of weird stuff starts to happen.
Yeah.
But then when you get to the next dimension of learning, you get past the camera, you start looking at the person a bit more, and you start getting them to pose a little bit better, to smile a bit better, make sure the hair's not in their face, they haven't got a piece of spinach in their teeth or whatever it is.
Yep.
That's not the second dimension. You're a lot more conscious about the thing you're shooting rather than the thing you're shooting with.
Yes. Yeah, right.
And then once you start getting a little bit more comfortable shooting the person, then you start looking more at the background.
Right.
And then the background becomes your focus. When I shoot people, it's always the first thing I always look at is the background.
Yeah.
And at what lens do I need to make that background look the way I want? And then I pull backwards to the second dimension to where does that person go in that environment? And then back to the first dimension to, well, what settings do I need?
Mm-hmm.
I think people learn 1, 2, 3, but when you get good at shooting, you shoot 3, 2, 1.
Right.
If that makes any sort of sense.
Hmm. Yeah, it does.
Yeah,
I'm not sure. I agree with it, but I understand where you're going.
Well, that'd be the difference between yourself and myself, though, Bruce. Is I'm right.
Yes.
Hey, when I want your opinion, I'll give it to you.
Thank you. And given that you're shooting way more than I am, I will just shut up.
Well, you know, maybe it depends on where you are in your learning, too.
Yeah.
Or where you are, probably not so much in your learning, but how you see the world.
Yeah.
You know, I see the world talking to people like my mate Mike Holman, he sees the world in this very narrow viewpoint of how a lens sees the world first and foremost.
Right.
But you know, the difference is he's mostly a landscape shooter, but I'm mostly a person shooter, but I've still got to put that person into a landscape. So it's always going to be that third dimension first to establish that.
Sure.
Before anything else, before the other pieces fall into place.
Hmm. Okay. Yep. That makes sense.
Or I could be just full of it.
You know? Now, we have one other thing on the list.
Do we?
Yes. And that was the use of images and lack of payment because you're doing it for the for the exposure, as it were.
The exposure. Yeah, so I've mentioned a couple of times this podcast, a fantastic Melbourne photographer called Bill Gekas.
Right.
Gekas. I'm going to catch up with him in a couple of days, hopefully, and I'll try and con him to ask him to come on the podcast and have a chat with us. He's a remarkable photographer. But yeah, he was ranting, in other words, posting on Facebook today that yet another ad agency had contacted him, wanting to use some of his images for some of their marketing. And of course, they haven't got any budget, but they'd be happy to give him exposure and put his name on it.
Yeah.
And funnily enough, yeah, for the amount of work he puts into his images, he wasn't going to do that. But it has become the norm these days that people expect that that so-called exposure is enough. These advertising agencies, these people who want to get your images for nothing.
Yeah.
And what is the value of exposure to someone? What's the goal? What's the reality of giving away your hard-earned work for what?
Yeah.
Is that something that's ever come across you by any chance? You've been offered?
I've been offered exactly the same thing. I got contacted by a television production company from London about 2 years ago because I shot a 7-image panorama of the Sydney Cricket Ground.
Yeah.
In February, it would be probably three. Would it be 3 years ago? The Victorian bushfires.
I think isn't getting close to five.
Or really? Is it that far? It probably is. I wouldn't be surprised.
It was a while ago. Yeah.
Anyway, I was at the Sydney Cricket Ground in the members stand for the Victorian Bushfire Appeal charity match, and I shot this 7-image panorama from the members stand of the SCG under lights with the fading daylight in the background. And it's stitched together beautifully. You can see that image on brucewilliamsphotography.com in the panorama section. And anyway, this TV company got in touch with me. They were doing some...
exposé.
Imaging and packaging for the cricket.
Right.
Coverage for Channel 4 in London, I think it was Channel 4. And they wanted to know if they could use this image in the, the opener that they were putting together, but remarkably, they had no budget.
Oh, that's a shame.
So I told them no.
Gee. But the exposure, though, Bruce.
Yeah.
They'll be giving you, several 30-second commercials on BBC 4 or something.
I'll slap a big watermark across the middle of the image. Is that going to be the exposure?
Look, I'm sure there are some times where that has great value. But you'd want to be very careful what you're doing, how you give away your images to these sort of people. Because there's so many people. I think you used the word very quickly. They contacted you.
Yes.
It's a bit of a con.
They talk about exposure, but they're not going to put your image out there in an advertising context with your watermark on it. So how is it exposure for you?
Well, they're going to give you 5 30-second commercials in the middle of the cricket.
Yeah, right.
Exactly. You're going to get absolutely nothing out of it. It's ego stroking. It's all it is, really. Yeah. Oh, this guy wants to do that, and they're going to use my photo. Look. Oh, there it went. Oh, you missed it.
how often? I would ask anybody, either you or anyone listening to this podcast, how many times have you seen a fantastic photograph used in any advertising context, whether it be TV, print on the bus shelter, cinema advertising, whatever? How often have you seen a photograph and gone, wow, that's amazing, I wonder who shot that, and then actually gone to find out who shot it?
I do know the answer to that one. None.
Yeah, exactly. So it's not exactly exposure. If nobody learns your name...
Every time I see a great image on the bus, I was going to look for the watermark. Oh, who shot that?
Yeah, right. That's my point. Like,
does he have a website?
Exactly. So
do you know what I do, though?
What?
I do dissemble every image. Okay, where was the light source?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Pull them apart, because if it's a good image, you want to copy and steal it for yourself.
Definitely.
Take inspiration from is what I mean, of course, to say that in a non-libel way. But that's it. I think there's absolutely no value at all to any of this sort of stuff. But it seems to be, is it? There's enough people out there, I'm sure, who'll say yes to it. I guess it's the kind of, there's probably enough people who respond to, you just won $20 million from Nigeria. they would keep doing it if no one was falling for it.
Yeah, exactly.
So I'm quite sure it works the same way in the photographic world. Yeah. It'd be interesting to ask our listeners, the 7 of them that I think would. I wish my family would stop listening. It's kind of embarrassing when we talk about it at the dinner table. But have they been approached? What was their feelings? Did they agree to it? And did they feel they got any value out of it? I know I'm approached by Getty all the time for images, and it's like, nah. Yeah, literally every week. Yeah, they're on. And I had a recent email from a customer saying that he'd taken several photos at a workshop, and Getty wanted to buy them off him, right, or get them off him in the library. Now, would that be okay so he can make money out of them? And effectively, they're not realistically his images. They're his version of my images.
Yep.
I've got no problem with it because if he can make a buck out of it, good on him, frankly.
Exactly.
As long as the model's okay with it. And to my concern, it's more like, I'm more worried about the model being less short-changed. If he got a good chunk of change out of something like that, well, make sure the person's looked after a little bit. You know?
Yeah.
Personally, I don't care. It's my view, as always, is it's their version of an image I've set up.
Yep.
It's not necessarily exactly my take on it. That's the thing. There's people out there, there's agencies out there all the time wanting very cheap or free images.
Yeah.
Yeah. What's the real value of a photo these days?
Hmm. Yeah. It's a tricky one.
It is. It is.
Because I don't think I was going to use the word value, but value is almost not the right word to use anymore. But, What we perceive as the value of an image is still there, but the other side of the coin is something I always remember my mother telling me, you know, something's only, you know, the value of something is only what someone's willing to pay for it.
Exactly.
And
if you're even going to sell it.
Yeah.
You know, a great friend of mine, my music crazy mate, his dad always used to say to him, he'd come running home, he'd bought this footy card for $2, but it was worth $10.
Yeah, right.
His dad would always say, well, show me the $10.
Yeah.
He goes, I haven't got it. He goes, well, it's not worth anything then, is it? until the cash is in the hand, you know.
Yeah.
But I collect rare books, antique books.
Do you?
I do. On a very specific subject.
Okay.
Fishing.
Right.
And I've got books going back to the 1700. Wow. But you know, some of those books are worth, and I'm doing the old inverted commas, are worth $2,500 a piece.
Right.
But they're not really worth anything, so I'll never sell them.
Yeah.
So what is actually a worth? Yeah, you know, what is the value of something? And it's never really there until you see the cash. Yeah, you know, there's no value in the exposure unless you get jobs.
Yeah,
giving that image away unless it gets you something.
It's an investment.
Well.
In that context, it's an investment. You've put cash into something in the belief that it is worth more than what you have paid for it, or that the longer you hold it, the more it will increase in value, and that at some point, your offspring, however many generations down the line, when they're hard up for a buck and have got nothing to eat, might be able to cash that in for a hell of a lot more than what you bought it for, and, you know, maybe either afford a loaf of bread or set themselves up in perpetuity with a roof over their head.
Yeah, exactly. But what's the value in the photo? What's the value of that so-called exposure that these companies are prepared to give you?
Yeah.
If you don't get something tangible back for it, if it's not something you can put food on your table with, pay your mortgage with, it's got absolutely no value. And theoretical exposure, theoretical profile building is all fine and dandy, but where's the proof?
Yeah.
How do you rate it? How can you possibly quantify these things?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think Jerry Maguire had it right.
Yeah, show me the money. Well, look, when I put the show notes up for this episode, I would love to hear from, or both of us would love to hear from the listeners. Tell us your war stories of what image you had in your collection that somebody wanted to used for advertising purposes, but remarkably had no money to give you in return. We'd love to hear your stories.
I was asked to have one of my images for a cover of a book.
Really?
I said, absolutely, but I want a book. So I want just send me out. That's all I wanted was one book signed, you know. But I don't know if they ever used the image. I never saw the book. It's very disappointing. It's 15 years ago. I'm still carping on about it now. Yeah. some things we just never, we hold on tight to some things, Bruce.
We do. We do.
If you haven't already, swing by the Facebook page and like it. It is facebookpage.com.
Tell your friends,
tell your family. facebook.com/Shutters Inc. podcast.
Because what happens when we get to 200 listeners, Bruce?
We give away another free podcast?
Another free podcast.
Excellent.
But this week, of course,
yes.
in honor of the Cyprus banking system,
yep.
We're going to do 10% off.
Right.
10% off the whole thing. You're going to wake up and all of a sudden it'll have 10% less value. 10% less content, 10% less laughs, and 10% less interest.
Fantastic.
You know what happens if you do all that, though? We'll have 10% less listeners next week as well.
More than likely.
let's go back to the Argentinian inflationary thing where, you know, it used to cost a bucket load of money to get a loaf of bread or something. You know?
That's
a better way of getting
a wheelbarrow. Yeah,
exactly. It's a bucket in the morning, wheelbarrow in the afternoon.
Yeah,
exactly. I had a friend who lived in Argentina during those days, and he could not buy a return bus ticket.
You serious?
Yeah, because it was more expensive to come home than it was to go to school. Serious.
Oh.
It used to cost more money to come home than to go. That's how high the inflation was.
That is ridiculous.
Crazy stuff. Yeah, whenever you got your wages, you had to spend it that day, the entire thing that day, because it was worth less the next.
Wow.
Amazing way to live a life, I tell you.
But surely the wages weren't going up at the same
yep.
rate. Oh, they were.
Yeah, everything, that's inflation. Everything was through the roof. And
well, I don't know. We have inflation in Australia, but my wages aren't going up.
Yeah, that's because you're not a nurse or a teacher.
Yeah, that's right.
They're all getting their pay rises, too.
Yeah, too true.
I tell you what, pay yourself an extra 20% for this episode. Yeah, out of all the income from iTunes for this episode, I have an extra 20%.
Excellent. I was referring to my other job, but yeah.
I see
where
you're coming from. Yes.
All right, mate. Good to talk to you again.
And to you.
And we
bye, everybody.
And we shall do it again next week.
Come back next week, everyone.
Right, see you, mate.
Bye.
Shutters Inc., another audio2you.com quality podcast. For previous episodes, check out ShuttersIncPodcast.com or search the iTunes Music Store. For questions, comments, and feedback, email theboys@ShuttersIncPodcast.com.